Okay. There it goes, listen. To a loose warbling wing. Seminars are going, and it just came to me the other morning so clearly that this line that Herbert Read quotes in the introduction, in the last couple of paragraphs of the introduction that we looked at last week, where he talks about Francis Webb being dedicated throughout all his work with this so tender voyaging line of truth. And that line comes up in a poem that he wrote when he was in England around Cossey, and it's actually in that extra sheet that I've given you. Don't look at it just yet. But it's more and more apparent to me that Francis Webb, as a result of his personal history, but not only as a result of his personal history, was deeply committed through his art, through his creativity, to finding that point in his own inner life that was connected to the truth, the voyaging line of truth. And you remember last week I said that in his exchange with Norman Lindsay, he was, you know, feisty against Norman Lindsay, and he was telling Norman Lindsay, all I want to do is get to the bedrock of my reality. Now, added to that, there is the fact that there was this great hole in Francis Webb's inner life. He didn't know, he certainly didn't know his mother, but he didn't know his father. He knew his father was still alive, but he had no contact with his father. And this emptiness in him, I think, really drove him as an artist to find ways creatively to open to this inner truth. I'll just wait till these people have settled down here before I continue. So do you want your name tag is up here? You got it? Okay. There's a chair here. There's a chair for you. Sorry, what is your name again?
Kevin.
Kevin, that's right. I've written your name on the list so you don't have to bother. Kevin. So just to backtrack a second then. So Francis Webb was this tender voyaging line of truth. You know, I relate to it very well myself. I'm sure we all do. It is a universal human phenomena, as I see it, that we are all closed off from our capacity to be open, you know, to be open to the truth 24/7. And these moments of opening, these moments that connect us to the truth, are, as I've put down at the bottom there, moments of grace and of love. And love is very far from certainly from me, love is something that we touch fleetingly. For Webb, it was incredible difficulty. He lived a life where his relationships were shattered. You know, he spent his life in mental hospital, where he tried as best he could to make connections, and did make connections. But it was through his art and his poetry that he reached out creatively. Now, what does that mean? This is a really important idea for me. What does it mean to, as a poet, as an artist, as a musician, to use these forms of human expression to reach out to the truth that is in here but is also out there? And it struck me that, particularly with On First Hearing a Cuckoo, which was a fairly early poem, that poem dramatizes his quest for coherence in the face of incoherence. And I think it was Michael who really kind of put, and we're going to come back to that stanza in a minute, and I actually want to go through this poem with you and highlight those areas where I see this struggle going on, and then this resolution at the end, and this connection with the music. I mean, for Webb to, as it were, be so connected with the arts, with music, with painting, and to find through those ways in which he could himself, as an artist, connect. So briefly, what we're going to do, we're going to come back to First Hearing a Cuckoo, then we're going to have a look at this amazing article by Judith Beveridge at the end. We're going to walk through it, and you know, she talks about making space for the inner life, and she talks about the scripture of the ground. And you know, Judith's right to come back to what I quoted last week. She talked about Francis Webb as someone who's done so much suffering for me. I've read him so much, and I think that's what poetry is for. What does that mean? What does it mean, so much suffering for me? Well, as I understand it, it means that he was so encased, you know, he was in a sense so wounded. We're all wounded, we all have difficulties, but he was in an extreme case. And yet, despite that extremity, he walked around with plastic bags with his books. He didn't give in. He was there in the face of his difficulty, producing work until his last breath, virtually. So extraordinary. That's the sort of suffering I think that Judith Wright's talking about. That's what poetry is for. And that's what Judith Beveridge comes to talk about. So we're going to move from there. Then we're going to move to this amazing early poem, An Old Record, which Frank Webb, as a young teenager, had this record that his father had owned. And it was a Caruso record from around about 1902, for God's sake. And An Old Record is a poem that describes this trying to hear through this crackly, crackly noise the sound of this musician, of this music. And what does he find? What does he come to? What does he connect with? And, you know, he links it up with this story of Charles Roland, the hero from Charlemagne's time, trying to make this impossible mission to this tower, which is here depicted in this amazing painting by, in 1859, by Thomas Moran. And Robert Browning wrote this brilliant poem, Child Harold to the Dark Tower Came. You know, we could spend a lot of time comparing that poem to this event. But that's a poem where Webb is kind of dramatizing his own quest, certainly for his father, but also for this truth that he hears through the music. And the record becomes a wonderful metaphor for, you know, the garbled scrub of the night, as he calls it, and the quest through for this moment of truth. And in that poem, An Old Record, he alludes to, indirectly, to this amazing sonnet by Shakespeare, Sonnet 65, where Shakespeare says, "Since brass nor stone nor earth nor boundless sea but sad mortality o'ersways their power, How with this rage shall beauty hold a plea, whose action is no stronger than a flower? Oh, how shall summer's honey breath hold out against the wreckful siege of battering days, when rocks impregnable are not so stout, nor gates of steel so strong, but time decays? Oh, fearful meditation! Where, alack, shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Or what strong hand can hold his swift foot back, or who his spoil of beauty can forbid? Oh, none, unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. And then we're going to go to the poems where the tender voyaging line of truth actually materializes in the verse. And it was in Norwich when Webb was a patient in Hellesden Hospital that he found this painting, and he found all these paintings, which I went to the Chatswood Library yesterday to photograph. He had a collection of paintings which he purchased through a literature board grant when he was over there. He should have used the grant to, you know, feed himself or what have you, but he went out and blew it all in an antique shop in Norwich and bought all these Norwich School's paintings. And, you know, they connected up with his interest in the sea, as his grandfather was a ferry master on the Sydney Harbour. And his uncles used to drive, you know, big yachts on the harbour, so there was a sort of a very much a strong sea connection. And he lived, of course, down at North Sydney with his grandparents to begin with. But these paintings depict aspects of the Norwich landscape, and he was deeply moved by art, essentially. But the way that these artworks connected with the divine, and this is the painting that comes in the poem which begins, "Bird song is your reverberating touch." This painting there is a magnificent painting. Well, is it magnificent? Peter will tell us whether it's magnificent. But these paintings had kind of iconic, mythic value for Francis Webb. A, he bought them and had them in his possession. And secondly, they just really caught him at a moment of deep need in England, and he was in mental hospital. He didn't have many friends, and yet he had this incredible capacity to connect with the history and the landscape and the artistry of the place. While he was there in Norfolk, he wrote there's another one, that's the poem Death. There's three poems that we're looking at there. He wrote his most famous poem about the Australian explorer Edward John Eyre. In England he wrote this, and he got Kate Fitzpatrick's volume of the explorer's journals, and he read about Edward John Eyre, who had travelled all the way from Adelaide around the Great Australian Bight to Perth, and had lost all his party on the way except for one Aboriginal tracker, and Eyre was really alone in the wastes with an Aboriginal tracker. And it's in that context that suddenly Eyre discovered the Banksia cochineal, the bright red Banksia. And this poem is a kind of an epiphanic moment where again, Edward John Eyre's journey, which was such a preposterous, egotistic grand search for grandeur. I mean, this is what Webb kind of hooked onto, is that these explorers were men of incredible ego. And Webb saw this in himself. He saw the constriction of his own egotism, strange as that may seem when he was, you know, in a bloody mental hospital. But there was this sense of wanting to voyage with them through the constraints of that ego to something that was freeing. So each of these journeys becomes like a metaphor. And the moment where he discovers the Banksia, "carry fire like the thurifer over my sandy tongue-tied barren ground." So And, you know, just a little quote at the top there. I finished the lecture now, I can go home. Top right-hand corner, Sir Herbert Read. Can you read it?
Yep.
That's it. Sir Herbert Read, I'll read it to you. Sir Herbert Read, who wrote the introduction to Webb's collected poems, was an art critic, but he was also, he wrote on a lot of literary subjects. And one of his passions was Gerard Manley Hopkins. And Gerard Manley Hopkins was, of course, one of the great mentors for Francis Webb. Gerard Manley Hopkins' poetry, the volume of Hopkins' poems that you'll see at the Chatsworth, the Willoughby Library, is the most thumbed volume of any book there. It scribbles all over it. And, you know, what is well known about Hopkins, if any of you have studied Hopkins at university, as I did, when you first meet Hopkins, you think, is this English or is it Russian? It's just so, you know, and that's exaggerating, of course, but it is so tortured and dense, but yet not. And, well, what Herbert Read said about Hopkins, he said that Hopkins had such an intensity of experience that he was forced to remake the English language. In a way, you could say that about all art. You could say that about modernism as against, you know, pictorial realism in the 19th century. You can say that about Beethoven versus, you know, classical music of the 18th century. All art forms have to kind of create. Jackson Pollock, I was just looking at Jackson Pollock in New York with my students, trying to make sense of that and how that links in with New York poets. Breaking away from old ways of representation. Jackson Pollock said, damn this need to create subjects. I want to create energy. I want to create something that is a reflection of my living life now. So I'm not going to paint a tree and a house. I'm going to chuck paint across the board and I'm going to throw myself on it and splash here and splash there. That's going to be my work of art. And it is, and it was, and it's amazing. And, you know, they bought blue poles for how many million dollars in the art gallery. Everybody thought it was crazy. But so artists generate new ways of expression when they have new things that need to be expressed. And I certainly see Frank Webb in that mold. Okay, so that's where we're going today. So let's go back to the beginning. So you've got, just have a look at On First Hearing a Cuckoo. I'd just like to walk through the poem with you, and then we can have a bit more of a discussion about it, and you can raise any questions or any thoughts, any additions that you might have. So the poem, it's in a way, it's like a symphony on the colour green, with the sound of the word cuckoo going through it. And of course, green has got dual connotations of life and animation on the one hand, but restriction, envy on the other hand. You know, green is not something that's got a simple connotation. So in the first stanza, he begins with this focus on the word, on the words of the cuckoo. It was never more than the two unchanging words heard first in the coming green of daybreak. And he defines this kind of green, the sleepier green than sleep, with a sheer white between this yawning advancing green and the colour of all lights out. So a kind of a greenness between dark and between full greenness. And now this next three lines is really important. Not consciousness, the awakening early green. So this awakening early green that somehow is opening, resonating in him, is not consciousness. What's consciousness? For consciousness, for that, was the steep curtain, immediate structure of pain and learning, familiar rattlings. So when we enter consciousness, when you wake up from sleep and come in, suddenly you're overwhelmed with all those things you've got to do, all the chaos of your thoughts, all that. So it's not that. This green is separate from the kind of mechanized aspects of one's thinking, one's consciousness. Next stanza. With this taut white weariness, is he describing his own kind of apprehensive state of awakening? With this, two words involved themselves, formed and changeless, cool and haunting. It's as if these words, these sounds, are transformative. They're having some kind of transformative impact on his state of mind. Now, when we come to Judith Beveridge's article in a minute, you'll see that she talks very much about poetry creating an inner space, talking about inner landscape. And what is happening here, it is a poem that is describing an inner awakening process with all its various currents. Because they were of distance, these two words, I tended to link them with the young tremulous begging green now scrambling in a tree, moon-eyed at the window, wanting to be let in. Yes, now the breeze of green rejected distance, pulled cleverly at the curtain, exposed the laundry mark, disordering the image while reaching not the self's hand-scoring rigs. So there, that whole little thing is like a little drama, it seems to me, a drama of different shades of green, and yet the wind is pushing the curtain, there's a greenness coming in, exposing a laundry mark, disordering the image, but not quite reaching the self's hand-scoring rigs. That's a kind of an image of some sort of tension that's about to awaken. But then suddenly you have, against this kind of inner complexity, you have, but they were quite apart, so freely entering, so at home, not softening, not disturbing, but making distant. So there's the quality of these words of the cuckoo, which is connected up in his mind also with the colour green. And then he says in the last three lines of this stanza, old story, devious green, all shapes and sizes of illusion turned right out of doors. And you know, this strikes me personally as a kind of a description of what happens in meditation. You know, in meditation, all shapes and sizes of illusion, old story, devious green, all the kind of things that come up and, in a sense, stand in the way of what one is trying to open to. And here he says, turned right out of doors. All these things are turned right out. Two words, always the same words, freely entering. You know, this could be, I mean, I don't know to what extent I'm twisting it, but this could be the simple words of a mantra that comes in meditation. Not that Webb would have agreed with that necessarily, but there's certainly something of that quality. The power of these two words, freely entering. Then he goes into other manifestations of green that happen during the day, and the cuckoo's around all day. This poem takes place over 24 hours, it seems to me. Heard next whilst playing cricket at 11, in the robust green, long strider and talker of vital distances, while the downs kept on and on. The downs are the ridge of chalk hills, the southern downs in Surrey, near where his aunt lived and near where he was actually hospitalised at the time. While the downs kept on and on, voyaging green, and chafed the skyline's thin stalkage of personal mood along their sides. So, you know, he's again bringing in images of his own perhaps stiffness or anger that's somehow being corroded or rubbed or somehow softened by the voyaging green. And then an image of the way other things are being influenced by greenness in nature. Trees bulge, battening on a sleek green's passionate act and story, plump with spring. And here, among the withstood gross distances, green loggerheads, blockhead, restrictiveness. Is he again here talking about himself? Is he dramatising the withstood gross distances, green loggerheads in the daytime? He's still kind of choked up with himself, as we all are, all the time. When are we actually free? When do we have the breath of freedom, the breath of openness, the breath of stillness? When is it there? how much of the time are we actually there, and how much of the time are we usually in a state of, you know, green loggerheads? But for Webb, as he writes this poem, as he enters into the experience of that event, two level and small words, never at odds with self, never with green. He keeps coming back again and again. This artwork is like a vehicle for him to keep connected to his tender voyaging line of truth. And last at dinner, when the dissolute green, again a green of restrictiveness, summoned to bedside each image, unelectric against late lights out, gay sufferer with the syrinx become this tree, enigmatic as a covered statue, green shoulders of the downs converge to the humble, drooping lekithos, oil flask, which, you know, has got obviously some substance in there, some containing something of the essence of the evening. The dead souls unstirring at the folded forelock, shadows freeze, sad elongated faces, fine hands extended, downward pouring the wind, shivering in the queasy grey trickle of nightfall and mixing airs, dissolving distances. Now, I take all that, what I've just read, at last at dinner, the dissolute green, well, it's complex, but to me it describes the complex state of entering into nighttime, entering into an approach to death, entering into a sense of perhaps disintegration. And in a sense, the meaning of these lines comes more into focus, almost like a musical composition, when we hear the sounds of that cuckoo again. Dissolving distances, then the changeless words, unelectric among the going green and the advancing colour of lights out and the nagging strands of an anger, and cool before the cavernous green of sleep which alone could lose them. And then we come to this last stanza that Michael really helped us with last week, which in a sense brings all of this drama into a beautiful coda. What in themselves? It's sort of Standback's questioning how his day's experience in this complex day, every day is complex, but here today he's heard the cuckoo, and the cuckoo has had this new impact and has led to the creation of this poem. What in themselves? 12 hours shaken away. Not the abandoned green remain, not self. Not spring, not Surrey, no, nor merely a dead word-haunted man. And that's his kind of, that's his assessment really of where he's been most of the day, a dead word-haunted man. But I think he's being pretty heavily self-critical there because he's produced this work. Two words remained, the language foreign, childish perhaps, or pitiable, heedless of enmity. Heedless of enmity, heedless of hostility, free of hostility, free of all antagonism. And he's digested this. It's almost Eucharistic. He's taken these words into his consciousness. Again and again coming to a taut candor. Candor, a wonderful word. Candor means being open, honest, frank, impartial. To a taut candor, and then it's taut candor to a loose, warbling green. Okay, let's have some of your thoughts about all that. Where have I gone astray? Where have I twisted it too much? What do you differ on? Do you have a sense of this? Am I stretching the point, the so tender voyaging line of truth? What he's after here? Let's have some thoughts. Responsive thoughts. Anyone like to say anything? Ambrose. About what? Oh, sorry, you got the mic there, yeah. Yeah, that's it. Go.
I'm still not clear. It sounds a bit ignorant, but I'm still not clear what the colour green really represents. Because he's obviously great. He's overusing it just about.
Yep.
In lots of different ways.
Like a leitmotif.
Yeah. So if you just maybe enlighten us on that.
Okay. So, the coming green, I mean, obviously it's spring. Spring is the time, particularly in England, when everything becomes green. Things awaken. And so green is the colour of new life, new birth, colour of nature, all that. So the poem, like a work of art, like a piece of music perhaps more, because it's actually quite explicitly connected to Delius's on first hearing the cuckoo in spring. This was a piece of music that really spoke to Frank Webb. So like a piece of music, it's looking at green in all its different aspects. And I've just isolated a contrast between green, which seems to be animating and free and beautiful and enlivening, and the green that he also identifies in a phrase like green loggerheads or dissolute green. He there sees the opposite side of green, its negative connotations. I don't know if you know William Blake's Songs of Innocence. There's two Songs of Innocence called the Nurse's Songs. And in one of the Nurse's Songs, green is the colour of awakening nature. And in the other Nurse's Song, green is the colour of jealousy, which forces the nurse to want to kind of restrict and narrow the child's experience. So something like that is happening with the use of the word green here. Does that help a bit?
It does, thank you, yeah. So there's a relationship with nature in a positive way.
Yep.
But of course the poet, let alone the artist, always views nature as being two-sided.
Yes.
Right.
And his own nature, his own human nature also.
That's right.
It's his human nature, in fact, that seems to get in the way of most things in the natural world out there.
So it's so it's a play on that in a way.
Yeah.
Okay.
A play on it. It's like, what is art? Art is a kind of, I didn't want to use the word representation because this is,
recreation.
A recreation, Peter, thank you. Yeah, good. Do you have something more to say about it, Peter, about this poem?
Read it out.
Yes, please, read it out. Take the microphone.
A little bit of reference to last week about meeting Frank Webb when I was psych nurse back in 1971. But anyway, I'm first hearing the cuckoo and some notes on the first and subsequent readings. After first meeting Frank Webb at Rodney Hospital back in 1971, he lent me his collected poems, and I thought about that. I sort of asked if it was okay to borrow them, but he lent them to me, whether that was a vulnerability or being a very trusting, generous person or both. Being an inmate in an institution was a loaded situation. Anyway, as I remember, I lent him a book on Vincent Van Gogh in return, so we did a deal.
Yeah.
Anyway, a brief furtive reading of some of his poems back then. I recall a surprise shock in that poem of that curtain blowing, revealing an exposed laundry mark, which is a rattling of, to use that word, of realism in that lengthy music, green, complex poem. Otherwise, like salt-bearded Michael, I was baffled by his ineffable language. And those two words, only sounds haunting and meaningless, appearing, disappearing at random in that 12-hour shaken, which is a bit like shaking laundry, shaken up into the past. And that line, old story, devious green to tell a tale. Last week I mentioned the idea of cuckoos, ruthless nesting habits, maybe having some reference, but I've given up on that idea.
Good.
anything other than the title, as solid creatures, the cuckoos, they're neither specified nor spelt out. They're only heard. They're not seen. sounding an enigmatic and benevolent presence from a source unknown, which could be echoes of a divine one, without mentioning Christ. Anyway, a thoughtful Sherlock Holmes could spend 12 hours peering and plumbing the various depths, including familiar rattling sounds of curtains opening, trolleys, suggestion of a hospital or barracks setting against the lights out image. He only suggests that. Anyway, this intensely scientific poem, the waiting narrator, thinker, going way beyond the field of cricket at 11. The word haunted man, dead soul upon Greek vases, pouring out an eternal endless English pastoral scene. The image of the downs kept on and on. And then plump with spring, or those nagging strands of an anger. That's where I've written, what have we learnt by that steep curtain of a day's beginning? Pain. Anyway, literate limitations, I've vowed only to do one page of comments, and adding the cuckoo reference. I remember a conversation with Frank one day, and he said to me, I'd love to join Brotherhood and become a priest. And then another day he said to me, I'm hearing kids' voices. I don't think they'll accept me in the priesthood. I'm dingbats. And that's the term he referred to himself. He was dingbats. And so if you want, he's using a pun on cuckoo.
Great, thank you. Beautiful, Peter. Thanks. You've added a whole other dimension there to what we've talked about. It's fantastic.
But I think that pun...
Could be. Thank you.
It's not important.
No, I think everything's important. So we've got... Anyone like to respond to anything that Ambrose or Peter or I've said? Any other further thoughts?
I'd like to know...
Microphone, please. Oh, yes. David?
Yep.
Talk into it.
Hello.
Yeah, that's it.
I'd like to know when Francis Webb was formally diagnosed in the psychiatric situation.
Around about when he was writing this poem. Yeah, because that was the first breakdown he had, and he was hospitalised in England. I mean, I don't know whether they actually come up with the full diagnosis then that he got when he was in Parramatta, chronic paranoid schizophrenic. I don't know whether that was then the label that he got on him. But he was certainly very acutely conscious of labels after that point. Yeah.
Reading, since we're...
Microphone.
Oh, here we go.
Yep.
Reading, since we're all together last time, melancholy came to the fore for me.
In this poem?
I might be projecting.
No. So in particular, can you put your finger on something in particular in there that gave you a sense of melancholy?
Being personal, in 1973, I think the poem, I was actually in a rat house, so to speak. It was a psychiatric hospital, and I was diagnosed with... what do they call it then? Depression, but manic depression.
Yep.
And anxiety. And I think it's not politically correct to call it manic depression anymore.
Yep.
And I just was reflecting on that.
Yep.
And the people I met there and who met me were transitory.
Yep.
You know, and purely reflective.
Good. Okay, well, I'd just like to put back the question then to you all. Do you think that this poem is Frank Webb, someone who's obviously, you know, obviously has difficulties, he has inner conflicts, Is it a poem in which we see the artist reaching out through the sound of this cuckoo for some source of stability in the face of his inner complexity? Is that how you see? That's how I see the poem. And I see this poem as an illustration of this. So yeah, go please, Michael.
Two words caught the end.
Yep.
One's at the beginning, and one's near the end. Still puzzling over that.
Where's the one in the beginning that you noticed?
In the beginning of the second stanza.
It's taut white weariness. Yep.
So the two words that seem to be summoning him into a whole new area.
Yep.
Grappling with this taut white weariness, which I suppose is his unwillingness, perhaps, or inability to go there.
Into the day.
Yeah. Where the two words are summoning, where the cuckoo's call is in fact summoning him. And is there a sort of a coming to terms that's like trying to break free of the taut white weariness?
Because the two words are not the taut white weariness.
They
enter into it, they involve themselves, and they're different from the taut weariness.
Am I right in they're summoning him? Let go of that.
That's right, that's how I see it. They're summoning him to let go of that formed and changeless, cool and horny. They are objective. They're somehow objective above the subjectivity that he recognizes so well of his own inner. To pick up, Peter said, what did he call himself? Bats?
Dingbats.
Dingbats.
On dingbats.
Yeah.
So it's a question of control and surrender, I suppose.
Surrender.
Mm. Yeah. And then he comes to a point where taut is used sort of in a positive way. It's a taut candor.
That's right.
That oxymoronic.
It is.
To a loose warping green. Like he's shifted from this, he's moved out, he has escaped a little bit from the taut white wariness, but it's given way to a taut candor. I'm still resting in that now.
Ambrose, yeah.
To understand that in the first instance, I think he's identifying the difference between the person, be it the poet or the person generally, their spiritual state, and their limitations with the language that they have to describe the world. These sounds are outside of that.
That's right.
They're not in our control.
That's right.
In a sense.
Yeah.
So they're very liberating.
Yeah.
But at the end of the poem, he gets to use the word taught again in describing them, in the sense that he still is going to still credit them with a certain amount of discipline and order. So there's more of that in there.
That's lovely,
so
I like that.
Throw away.
I love that.
Line, yeah.
That's beautiful. That's really good. And I had a brilliant thought. And it's just disappeared out of left field. Mari, you want to add something?
Well, that triggers off my connection, deep connection with the meditation that you mentioned earlier. And the discipline of the mantra that calls us from, you know, often the thoughts in the sense of everything else that's clinging or pushing us to another space.
That's it. That's right. Beautiful. Yeah. Yes, please, Jared.
Can I just say something in the microphone?
Not Jared, sorry, not Jared. Gavin, go on, please, Michael.
Something, a violin string is taut. It has to be taut, otherwise it can't release the music.
That's beautiful, It can't release the music, that's exactly right. That's
I'm sorry to add to the...
A bit closer, Gavin.
...the discussion about taut. The first line says two unchanging words, so it feels really to think the poem's about that, which is lack of change and stability or tautness.
Yep.
But as you read through it, there's all these verbs which are about blurring and change and disintegration, which makes the poem really lovely. So disordered, voyaging, drooping, dissolving, abandoned, warbling. They're all sort of images of movement, yes, and blurring and disintegration,
yes,
which I think means the poem isn't about what it initially appears to be about, which is the lack of change,
yep,
or link that back to the tautness,
yep,
which we need. I just want to make another point quickly. I grew up in South Africa.
A bit closer.
I grew up in South Africa.
Yeah.
When I first went to England, I was shocked at the colour green because it was completely different to the
colour,
right, I grew up in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when I came to Australia, I was really surprised at the colour green in Australian nature.
Yep.
It's completely different to Africa,
yep,
and Europe. So travelling around, they're just different colours completely.
You're right.
And I'm sure he might have had a similar experience,
yes,
going from Australia to Europe.
That's it, sure.
Yeah,
good. And what I particularly like about what you said, Gavin, the way you were expressing your admiration for the verbs and the complexity of the state that was described in there, and the contrast between that and the resolution into the two warbling green. I mean, the way you're reading it is exactly the way I think Francis Webb was sort of composing it. It's a poem that is, it's like a piece of music. It's like an abstract work of art in a way. It's got all these shifting colours in there, all these dissonances, and then this flow through to this, you know, this kind of objective experience of the two words, free words, up here, something like that. Okay,
just
go.
If you think about, you mentioned Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock's paintings always have consistent colour themes in them.
They do.
Which is what this has as well.
That's very interesting. And you know, Jackson Pollock was painting exactly the same time as this poem was written. And not only that, but Webb was in America, in Canada, and he was very attuned to what was happening in American poetry and American art at the time. So, you know, that's all good connections. Now, I want to spend 10 minutes, like 10 minutes before our cup of coffee, so just hold tight on your chairs. We're going to go and have a quick look through Judith Beveridge's article at the end of your booklet, and we're going to start on page 34. And this is an article that she wrote, which is called Making Space for the Inner Life. And there's so much in this article that really helps to understand what poets and what Francis Webb in particular are trying to do. So I'm just going to read bits of it, and if you want to break in and make a comment, please feel free to do that. So starting with the second paragraph, throughout history, poetry has always been the most powerful and effective form for addressing and exploring deep spiritual questions. Partly this is because poetry is connected so intimately with the breath. Poets know that the breath can act as an interpreting spirit, something which will help move and uplift and carry lived experience into rhythms and tones, which allow both writer and reader to feel as if they are in communion and intense dialogue with the world around them. You know, I think this breath and oh, that's right, that was my brilliant idea 5 minutes ago, and it really connects up with what I said to you, Gavin, and that is that what is so important in all poetry, but particularly in Webb's poetry, is texture. You know, texture is, you feel texture in a carpet, but you feel it, you can see it in a painting. The texture of his, you know, dark greenness and then the cool greenness. There's an incredible sense of texture. Peter would know more about texture than I do in paint. You look at the painting behind you there, it's filled with texture. Look at the wild honey, the painting right in the middle there, the softness coming through the trees there at the bottom, and then the thickness in the young woman and in Frank Webb's head there looking forward. We're going to explore that painting in relation to the poem later. How do you translate texture of words into texture of paint? And I noticed that Peter has kind of, while Ward 2 is a series of a number of poems, and this canvas is all those poems, and he's embedded it on a texture of a kind of a Van Goghian or modernist Van Goghian kind of, reverberations in the background. I'm sure Peter will tell us more about this when we get to it next week. Let's read on here. Next paragraph. Poetry as an art form employs repeating structures of sound, image and rhythm. And this patterned approach enables both writer and reader to access knowledge in non-discursive ways. And it then goes on to talk about a poem that we looked at the last seminar that we held here. We looked at the Blake Prize winner for last year, Graham Kershaw, Alter Rock. We just skip past that and skip to three lines past that quote. As Kershaw points out, spirituality is broader than religion. It's in how we engage imaginatively, emotionally, and intellectually with the world. Spirituality is also about perceiving relationships. Poets become especially practiced in this through metaphor making. Metaphors build bridges and create new pathways of understanding. What is the metaphor of the cuckoo sound? Metaphors then can be seen as having a healing or remedial function. Image, in its truth-telling, allows for an expansion and activation of knowledge. We need the poet's eye to explore, to celebrate, to make the familiar extraordinary, and to make space for the inner life. Skip the next paragraph. A great deal of poetry does not directly engage with political or social issues, but what it does deal with is inwardness, or the inner life. A poem to be successful has to come from inside the poet's own life. This ability of poetry to go inwards and to touch the psyche both at an individual and communal level is one of its most significant forces. W.H. Auden says this memorably in his memorial to W.B. Yeats. With your unconstraining voice, still persuade us to rejoice. The poet, he's talking about the poet, what Yeats has to do. With the farming of a verse, make a vineyard of the curse. Sing of human unsuccess in a rapture of distress. I think Webb does that all the time. Sing of human unsuccess in a rapture of distress. First Hearing a Cuckoo is a poem of rapture, even though it has a lot of distress. In the deserts of the heart, let the healing fountain start. In the prison of his days, teach the free man how to praise. Yeats was a genius. Yeats was incredible. Incredible. Continuing, in the past, poetry was more community-centred. It functioned to draw people together. Poetry was a vehicle for transmitting the stories, beliefs and values of a people. While the communal function of poetry may have diminished in modern times, poetry has never lost its role, which Wallace Stevens has described as a response to the daily necessity of getting the world right. Isn't that amazing? The daily necessity of getting the world right. That's what poetry is for. That's how poetry can serve us. You know, I read a Mary Oliver poem every morning. It helps me get it right. Yes, Peter?
Remember Frank said once, blessed be the poor, he said a good one to the artist is blessed be those who seek justice. And that was his one for art.
For art, blessed be those who seek justice. Beautiful. Lovely. Next bit. One of the dangers that we face as a culture, with so much of the natural world disappearing, with so much of the environment slipping into degradation, and so much of it reduced to cityscape, pop culture and consumerism, is that people can easily slip into self-centeredness and lack of attention. Now, isn't the cuckoo on First Hearing a Cuckoo, isn't it a quest for attention in the face of chaos? Continuing, we are quickly losing a direct, intimate connection with the things we depend upon for survival. Poetry is a great tool through which human relations to nature can be called to account as well as exalted. Writing and reading poetry forces us, if we are to become any good at it, to pay attention. Mary Oliver says, before we move from recklessness to responsibility, from selfishness to a descent, from selfishness to a decent happiness, we must want to save our world. And in order to want to save our world, we must learn to love it. And in order to love it, we must become familiar with it again. That is where my work begins and why I keep walking and looking. At its best, poetry provides us with an active means of empathic enlargement. Many poets, I think, would agree with Keats when he said that writing poetry was essentially... Sorry, I haven't changed the screen. As essentially about soul making. Keats, about soul making. In one of his letters to John Hamilton Reynolds, Keats wrote, "I find that I cannot exist without poetry, without eternal poetry. Half the day will not do it, the whole of it. I had become all in a tremble from not having written anything of late. The sonnet on the sea did me some good. I slept the better last night for it. This morning, however, I am nearly as bad again." End quote. Back to Judith Beveridge. Australian poets are especially good at writing the scripture of the ground. Robert Adamson, Robert Gray, Martin Harrison, Les Murray, Mark Tredinnick, Judith Wright have written superb meditations on nature, metaphysics and mortality. Many of their poems take us into active seeing and from contemplation into response. Skip the next quote. Last bit. "Perhaps the most outstanding responses of all are the Aboriginal song cycles, which deliver extraordinary power through rhythm, mythology, cultural references and sacred connections to place." Here are some lines from part 13 of the song cycle of the Moonbone. "Up and up soars the evening star, hanging there in the sky. Men watch it at the place of the dugong and of the clouds and of the evening star. A long way off at the places of mist, of lilies and of the dugong, the lotus, the evening star, hangs there on its long stalk held by the spirits. It shines on that place of shade, on the dugong place, and onto the moonlight clay pan. The evening star is shining back towards Milingimbi and over the Woolamba people." End quote. The indigenous people have understood perhaps more than any group that no place is a place until it has had a poet. We can extend this thought further to include the understanding that if we want to best learn about the human spirit, about what it means to have human consciousness and sentience means capacity for sensation and feeling, to have human consciousness and sentience on this earth, then we cannot do better than turn to poetry. And now I'm going to ask you to turn to coffee. What a letdown. We come back and we're going to look at an old record. Ambrose, go. Microphone. Or was it just stretching? You were just stretching, were you?
I was halfway in between.
Go, tell us.
The use of the word poetry, obviously, I'd like to accept that if it's used in a broader term than just writing.
Yep.
So
sure.
I think that needs to be put out there because
I think so.
The poetic sort of vision of the world is much broader than
just writing a poem.
That's right.
I agree. That's beautifully put. Right,
yep. Yeah. As I recall, Katzenzakis, Zorba the Greek, and he, of course, he credits Zorba, who was very literate.
Yes.
And the whole thing was that he himself was very educated, and he realised that he was going to learn more from Zorba than he would learn from his own colleagues.
Yeah, that's right.
Because he lived life.
That's right.
And I suppose in a way we get that also from the Aboriginal people in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a very broad...
It's an important point worth making. Yeah. Yeah, please go, Peter, yes.
And the R...
Microphone.
And the irony of the cuckoo poem is that the poet in that is the cuckoo, the sound of the cuckoo. It's not webbed with all his thinking.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The poet is the cuckoo. It's not webbed with all his thinking. Well put. That's beautiful. That's really good. Please, now let's go not to cuckoos, but to coffee.